This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana and coming today on the eve of the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Our guests will include Mark Peruskia. His book, A Spy in Canaan, How the FBI Used a Famous Photographer to Infiltrate the Civil Rights Movement. Also, Missouri law professor Rigel Oliveri about the continuing issues of segregated neighborhoods in our country 50 years after the Fair Housing Act. And for much of the hour, we'll talk with LSU Mass Communications Professor Bob Mann, former top aide to Kathleen Blanco and John Breaux, and other politicians, including J. Bennett Johnston. He's here to talk about what's going on in state and national politics at the state capitol. We've got a session that is continuing to be uncertain. And what's happening in Baton Rouge in the aftermath of the Alton Sterling decision. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your numbers are 877-217-5757 anywhere, and in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. The email is talk@talklouisiana.org. We begin our discussion today on the eve of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King 50 years ago in Memphis, Tennessee, on April 4th, 1968. Many may not realize it that 7 days later, on April 11th of 1968, there was the passage of the Fair Housing Act, a seminal piece of legislation that historians believe would not have passed but for King's assassination. And with us to discuss this and the aftermath is Missouri law professor, University of Missouri, Rigel Oliveri. And good morning to you, Rigel.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to talk with you. Well, 50 years later, it doesn't take an Einstein to look around the neighborhoods here in Baton Rouge or in other parts of our country, and we give lip service to integration, but we live in a largely segregated country, don't we?
That's true. The numbers have gotten better. They're not as stark as they were in 1968 when the Fair Housing Act was signed, but they've only gotten better incrementally. The gains that I think everyone expected to come from the Fair Housing Act largely have not materialized.
Why are so many neighborhoods in so-called progressive areas segregated?
Well, and that's one of the really interesting things when you look at this, at the data, is that, you know, the most diverse areas are often the most segregated. And if you think about it, that makes sense. In order to have segregation, you need to have a meaningful representation of different groups. And so sometimes we might look at a city and think, oh, well, that city's very diverse. It has all different sorts of people. But when you drill down to kind of the neighborhood census data level, you see that the neighborhoods themselves are completely segregated. There's sort of sharp lines that delineate kind of where the different racial and ethnic groups live. And why is that? There are a lot of reasons. I think one of the reasons is just that housing is a very slow-moving indicator. Unlike some other civil rights laws that once they were put in place, they could kind of be immediately implemented, housing takes time. You know, if you've got a neighborhood that has been segregated over decades by government policy, housing industry practices, zoning and land use rules, you can't just turn around on a dime and change that. You know, it takes a long time to save the money to buy a house. It takes a long time to build capital in your home. And if you've been someone who's been shut out of the regular mortgage market for, you know, I don't know, a lifetime, that might mean that your housing stock in a particular neighborhood has never been able to appreciate in value with any significance, and that depresses prices over time. So things like that, you just can't turn around on a dime. They take long-term investment and real effort to change.
We've seen in the city where we're originating this show, in New Orleans, other cities that are so-called diverse cities, a black family will move into a neighborhood, and then another black family will move on the same block, and then suddenly all the white folks pick up and leave within a few years. That's an unfortunate aspect to this, but it's a reality. What can be done, if anything, to change that pattern?
Well, and that's a much harder situation, and that too has been happening since the 60s. In fact, it was a common tactic of real estate agents in the 1950s and 60s would be to do what was called blockbusting, which would be to deliberately introduce a black family or two to a neighborhood, and then tell everyone else in the neighborhood, you know, time to move. You know, your neighborhood's going to be taken over, and induce panic selling. And it benefited the realtors because then they could make the sales to the new black families that were moving in. And that's actually been made illegal under the Fair Housing Act to induce panic selling like that. But when it just happens sort of organically, when people just choose to move because they don't like the people who are moving in, there's not a whole lot we can do about that. My hope, and I think most of us in fair housing, our real hope is that, you know, if things gradually improve, people gradually get more used to the notion of living in somewhat integrated neighborhoods, that sort of thing won't happen as much. But I think that's still a ways off now.
Yeah, it's certainly evident in this community. There are streets that have never had a black resident, and there probably won't have one in my lifetime. And it's hard to believe that just happens by chance.
No, and I think that's another one of the most interesting things about fair housing is that there's so much of it. We look at our neighborhoods and who lives where, and you know what neighborhoods are like. And it's almost like the water we swim in. We just accept it as a given, as just the natural order of things, without really thinking about the decisions that have been made in financing, development, municipal services, all of the things that go into shaping what a neighborhood looks like and who lives there. So it's really easy. It's almost like the issue is so pervasive that it's easy to not see. Paradoxically.
Mm-hmm. Our guest for a few more minutes is University of Missouri Law Professor Rigel Oliveri. She has written some of the material in The Fight for Fair Housing, a book edited by Georgetown University policy expert Gregory Squires, and it's about the Fair Housing Act. 50 years ago, April 11th of 1968, this passed, was signed into law by President Lyndon Baines Johnson. What was the intent at that time? What were the expectations when this was put into law?
So one of the things that I think is important to think about was what was happening at this time. The civil rights community had passed Title VII, which guaranteed equality in public accommodations, so restaurants and things like that, and also in employment. And then a year later, the Voting Rights Act had been passed. And so the Fair Housing Act was really seen as kind of the final jewel in the crown of kind of major civil rights legislation. And it was seen as being necessary because even with all of those other gains, if people still lived in segregated communities, they would still largely be going to segregated schools. There'd be sort of differences in all sorts of differences that, I mean, it touches virtually every aspect of life. And so the idea was if this final piece can be put into place, that might start people getting used to living together, knowing each other, you know, more as neighbors. And so the hope was that would be accepted as the next piece of civil rights legislation. And in fact, it met with probably the most resistance of any. It failed the first time it went to Congress. And President Johnson had to try again the next year. And it looked like it was going to fail again. He was doing his arm-twisting best to get as many congressmen to vote for it, and he was having a rough time, and it looked like it was being stalled in the Senate. And then April 4th, Dr. King was assassinated, and I think it was a wake-up call for Congress and for many other people as to just how bad things were and how necessary positive steps were. And
all right, Dan downtown, I want to get Dan in. He's been waiting patiently. Dr. Oliveri. Dan, good morning. You're on the air with Professor Oliveri.
Yes, good morning. Professor, with a president whose own real estate experience included racial profiling, does it look like the prospects for improved housing situation is rather challenging?
What about...
Well, I'll be honest, yes. I am not optimistic right now, particularly for my part about HUD, because the Department of Housing and Urban Development plays a big role in helping to make sure that fair housing and affordable housing access is you know, given to all people. And right now, we have a HUD secretary who doesn't seem to think that that's a high priority, based on some of the decisions that have been made. And some of the budgeting proposals to eliminate funding for some of those programs. So I, at least for right now, my hopes are I'm going to try to be I'm not as optimistic as I otherwise might have been.
Well, we thank you for joining us, Dr. Oliveri, and it is an important discussion about an issue that many prefer to ignore. The book is The Fight for Fair Housing from Georgetown's Gregory Squires, which includes a chapter of note from Professor Oliveri about the legislative battle to pass the act in this book. It is profiled in a big way. Lyndon Johnson said that signing the law was one of the proudest moments of his presidency. Do you see any changes coming independent of President Trump in the next decade or so?
Well, I sure hope so. I think it's going to have to come more from the ground up right now. It's going to have to come more from the people, from local zoning authorities and local housing developers, and from the communities themselves.
Thank you very much, Rigel Oliveri. We'll be back with Bob Mann after this time out on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Sasha Gabashon is producing, and Bob Mann is our guest, LSU Mass Communications professor and a longtime journalist, and also he was an aide to some of the most prominent people in public life in Louisiana over the last few decades. 877-217-5757. Also the author of several books, some of which are about the civil rights movement of the 1960s. He is one of the foremost authorities on this, and we are on the eve of the 50th anniversary of the death of Dr. Martin Luther King, who was killed, assassinated by James Earl Ray, April 4, 1968, Lorraine Motel, Memphis, Tennessee. Bob, 50 years later, what do you think Dr. King would think?
Well, I would think he would acknowledge that we've made tremendous progress in race relations in this country, that life for African Americans and life for Americans in general is much better, that we're racially polarized country than we were in 1968, but we've still got a long way to go, and I think he probably would be surprised that we've not progressed all that far. I have a dream. I think he dreamed that we would we'd be a lot farther along the road than we are today.
Well, he died in 1968. You and I were young people, having been born in 1958, yep. And much has happened on a positive sphere since his death. As he said, the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. Sometimes justice takes a while.
Yes, it does, and it doesn't happen organically. It's, you know, we're ultimately, I think, talking about power here, and power in relationships, power differentials in relationships and in communities and in societies, and the people who have the power don't just give it up willingly, that it has to be taken from them. And that's why it's the way they call the civil rights struggle. It's a struggle. It's not something that just happens. It's got to be fought and wrestled from those with power.
877-217-5757 is your number wherever you are, and 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. We have dealt with some of these issues in the last year and a half after the death of Alton Sterling, and it reached a conclusion of sorts last week. And I think people on both sides of the issue are somewhat disappointed. Those who believe the officers did what they had to do are upset that one of them is fired, another suspended, and those who believe that this was an execution believe the officer should have been prosecuted. Can we get past this?
I don't know. I think we can. I think it's going to take strong leadership and this visionary leadership in this parish, in this community. And I don't mean just from City Hall. I mean from the pulpits of churches and the business leadership and community organizations all pulling together. Sometimes I don't think we're all pulling together very well. I think we've got to acknowledge we have a problem in ways that I don't think that we as a community have acknowledged it. I think we've got to admit to ourselves that this is really two communities, one white and one black, very separated geographically, economically, and otherwise. And we've got to resolve to do something about it. And it kind of surprises me. If you'd asked me a couple of years ago, do I think that these events might be the events that sort of shake up the community and force us to do something about it, and you know, including the flood, I would have said, yeah, I think this may be the catalyst that causes something to happen in this community, and I'm worried that we may end up being more divided after the dust settles from all of this.
877-217-5757 for Bob Mann, LSU Mass Communications Professor at the Manship School. David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on the air with Professor Mann.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for many wonderful columns, Mr. Mann, saying things that really need to be said.
Thank you, David.
And, you know, I was particularly impressed with your column regarding why people in Louisiana can't expect Amazon to locate their second headquarters there anytime soon. And what does it say, and what will it take for Louisiana to change to more progressive leadership? When I read recently where women living in poverty, Louisiana is rock bottom, number 50. If that's not enough to discuss and awaken voters to a change and to more progressive leadership, I think Louisiana is hopeless.
Well, we just, as a people, through our legislature, just voted down in the Senate, which is considered the more progressive of the two bodies of the Capitol, efforts to, A, raise the minimum wage to the level that the state of Arkansas has, and two, to pass a bill that would ensure equal pay for equal work. What's going on, Bob?
Well, I don't think we value the work and the contribution of women in business and society like we do men. Somebody I noticed on Twitter the other day, I thought had a really good comment, observation, said the only time that women and men are paid equally in this state is when they're both earning the minimum wage of $7.50 an hour. I think that the business lobby in the state, down at the Capitol, Louisiana Association of Business and Industry, and others have spun a convincing narrative that this is a zero-sum game, and that if we pay women more, if we pay people mm-hmm. more in general, that that everyone will suffer. And it goes back to something I've been saying all along. If I hadn't lost my column at the Picayune, I was about to write a piece on the fact that in Louisiana, I think one of our biggest problems is that we look at life through the lens of scarcity, not of abundance. We don't acknowledge and live out of the abundance that we do have and do with it what we could. We look at everything through scarcity. Oh, we don't have enough. We can't do this. We can't do that. It's a very defeatist way of looking at the world, and it's no wonder that we're last in so many things that are good.
Well, the situation at the Capitol is such that, as you say, the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry has a lot of clout. So does the Family Forum, and they even score lawmakers on minimum wage votes, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that it is shocking that I had a conversation the other day with a friend about this, and who I mean, it really perplexes me that the number of people of faith who look upon issues of taxation mm-hmm. and what I would call economic justice in a way that I just don't think is supported at all anywhere in the scriptures. If you're a Christian, or if you're a Jew, if you subscribe to if you're a part of a faith community that takes seriously what's written in the Old or New Testament, I just don't see how you can support policies that keep people in poverty, make them poor, that don't allow them to live that abundant life that Jesus talked about. It just perplexes me.
Also, the President of the United States has been given a mulligan for a relationship with an adult film star from Baton Rouge, Stephanie Gregory Clifford, better known as Stormy Daniels. And the latest Rasmussen poll has Donald Trump at 50%, 49% disapprove, but he's at the highest level of his presidency since the first few days. And this is after some bad news. The markets are not doing well right now. And, of course, this Stormy Daniels story has been the biggest story in the country for a week or so. How's he doing it?
Well, I think he's keeping people distracted in a way that has helped him with that, with the evangelicals, and has kept them from perhaps stopping to consider what are the consequences of what he's been accused of or what he has likely done. I noticed that whenever things get a little hot for Trump, he starts attacking immigrants, and we saw over the weekend that he issued a lot of tweets on this caravan of people coming through Mexico that he said we're going to apply for DACA, which is impossible. But I think there's a lot of distraction. There's a lot of, hey, look over here, look at this. Let me get you riled up about this, and it causes people to forget what maybe they otherwise might be a little concerned about.
Charles in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Charles.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to know from either one of you. I keep hearing these programs, and we talk about over and over the same thing that is haunting our state. And the one you just identified, the pay and minimum wage and so forth. But it never seems like, at least to me, on a daily basis, somebody comes up and says, Charles, if you will do this, it will help. Mr. Governor, if you will do this, it will help. Mr. Mann, if you will do this, it will help. Everybody just talks about it, but nobody says how to plan.
All right, we'll talk with Bob Mann about whether there should be a plan. Rather, the talk is cheap, as they say. We'll talk about this and more after this time out for the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Bob Mann with us for a little longer. He is an LSU mass communications professor, a longtime Politico, and has some thoughts about our world at large. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. On the eve of the 50th anniversary of the death of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Charles in Jefferson Terrace called before the break, and he was making the case that talk is cheap, and that's what we do here is talk, and sometimes talk elicits action, but more often than not, I think Charles is right, we talk and then things stay the same. Why is that the case?
It's human nature, I guess, but I also think that generally we don't, as a people, feel that that we have a problem, or that we don't believe that many of us don't believe that the problems are serious enough that they're threatening the very existence, future of our state and its young people. I think a lot of people are just blissfully unaware of how serious things are in the state, because a lot of them are just not affected by it in ways that so many of our people are. That's one of the problems of the geographically racial divisions in our community, that so many affluent people in South Louisiana never get up to South Baton Rouge, never get up to North Baton Rouge except to go to the airport. I think they're really unaware of what a food desert really looks like up there, what some of the people in those communities, the kind of housing that they live in. I think people need to get out more and really face up to the deep systemic problems that we have.
877-217-5757 is your number. And Bob Mann is with us for a little while longer. You can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We opened by talking about the eve of the 50th anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King. Bob was 9 years old. You were living where at the time?
Beaumont, Texas.
You recall it?
Yeah, I recall it like it was yesterday, because my father was a minister and was a sort of a part-time minister before he went into full-time ministry. And at that time, he had a black church in Beaumont, Texas, that he was serving as the minister to. And it was Wednesday night, and I grew up in the Church of Christ, and in the Church of Christ and a lot of other Protestant churches, there's always a Wednesday night Bible study. And we were headed to Wednesday night Bible study at my father's African-American church there in Beaumont. And we heard on the radio that King had been assassinated. And my father was just, you know, he wasn't sure what was going to happen in the black part of town. He was worried about violence. And, you know, there was violence in various places in the country. None that I'm aware of in Beaumont. But I remember he called the people and said, I'm scared to bring my family into, you know, part of town that I'm not sure what's going to happen. I think he would have gone if it had just been him, but he had the whole family in the car, and he turned the car around, and we went and did Bible study at some other church that evening. But I will never forget that.
Stuart in Southeast Baton Rouge. Good morning, Stuart. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Gentlemen, good morning. Can you hear me well?
Yes.
Wonderful. I'd like to comment. I presume society would deem me a gentleman of color, African-American descent, all of that type of foolishness that we gauge each other on ridiculously. I have no problem with recognizing people's different ethnicities. However, when it's used against them and when one group, I'm prefacing with this, when one group supplants themselves as supreme over another, that is where the ridiculousness comes in. Now, related to North Baton Rouge, food desert, the poverty and what have you, and my comments are usually not popular with the African-American community. I think in many instances, particularly today in 2018 in the 21st century, a lot of people inflict this ill on themselves. They refuse to get to take advantage of the wonderful free public education system that we have in this country. I cannot help it. What you do in the privacy of your home, if you get pregnant prematurely, if males are refusing to take care of the responsibility of their children, if you live this type of lifestyle, irrespective of your ethnicity, I mean, what can you expect? The overall outcome is more than likely going to be that you're going to continue living a life of poverty.
All right. Thank you, Stuart. Bob?
Well, I don't deny that there are people whose economic and family situations are dire because of their behavior and their lifestyle choices, but I just refuse to assign some sort of moral failing to poverty in general. I mean, for the first point I think is worth making is that the vast majority of poor people in this country are working, many of them working a couple of jobs at minimum wage, trying to keep their families alive. Most poor people in this country are employed and working and doing the best they can. They're taking advantage of the wonderful public school system, but they're often sending their kids to schools that, because of the neighborhood they're in, are neglected by the public school system, by the people of that county or the parish or the community, and that do not have the advantages, the spending that and the resources that schools in more affluent neighborhoods have. I just think it's just wrong to assign some sort of moral failing to poverty, because it's just all the evidence, all the experience that I have with working in that community over the years is that these are people who are working really hard trying to make it, and in many cases life is just stacked against them.
877-217-5757 in our remaining time with Bob Mann, and we want to touch base with him on a few matters, and he does teach journalism, and we have this mantra now of fake news. And Sinclair Broadcasting, which owns more television stations than any in the country, 193 of them, has ordered its anchors, and they have followed through if they want to work, and most of us do want to work, to recite editorials written by the management, stating that we have a problem with fairness and coverage. Is that an accurate summation of what's going on?
I think it's also worth, remembering that before the election in 2016, that Donald Trump Jr. had made a very famous pact with Sinclair to put out pro-Trump propaganda long before the election. And so this is a company that owns dozens of TV stations, local markets around the country, that has had a pretty long-standing alliance and desire to promote Trump. And I don't oppose a news organization that wants to editorialize on behalf of the president. Every news organization has that right. But this is Orwellian, I think, in a way that one of the news organizations put all those mashed all those statements together, showing dozens and dozens of these anchors saying the same thing, and I think it emphasized the truly Orwellian nature of this. Local news organizations like your show and local TV stations and locally owned television radios and radio stations and newspapers have a tremendous amount of credibility because they're seen as local news organizations. And I think now we're finding that a lot of them really aren't local in their nature, that they are controlled by large corporations that are headquartered thousands of miles away, and that there is some sort of central message now, at least with these Sinclair stations, that the anchors are required to give.
Jennifer on Highway 1. Jennifer, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Professor Robert Mann. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was listening earlier to the comments about poverty, people in poverty, and choices made and behavior. And what I'd like to share, I've been an educator since 1970, recently retired, and have encountered the most amazing research that I feel helps to support a better understanding of people in poverty, and that has to do with the ACE study from 1997 and 98, and the amazing research around that, showing the impact that childhood trauma as well as adult trauma has on individuals' choices in life, their learning abilities, their physical health, and relationships. And that happens to be something that I'm intensely interested in, and wondered if you were familiar with any of the research done by Bessel van der Kolk from the Boston Medical Center.
I'm not sure if I'm familiar with that specific research. I am familiar with there is a lot of research that's been done over the years. I think more recent research that I read in a book just a couple of years ago about all of the ways that that physical disabilities, physical illness, you know, eyesight, poor dental care, all of that has on the ability of these children to learn. So if you're coming from a family that doesn't have mm-hmm. dental insurance, or you can't afford eyeglasses, which in most cases aren't covered by insurance, even if you have it, you're at a great disadvantage when you get into school. You can't learn if you're hungry. You can't learn if your teeth aches or you can't see the blackboard.
Many of us, you alluded to it earlier, Bob, enjoyed your column with the Picayune and NOLA.com, and you lost your gig. Was it a political thing or a financial thing or both, or do you know?
Well, they told me it was financial. They told me they were paying me really well. I won't lie to you. They were paying me, they're probably paying me more than they should have. And so I'm very grateful for the 5 years that I had writing for the Picayune. It was always a dream of mine when I was younger to have a column in the Picayune. And I never told them this, but I probably would have written that column for nothing because I enjoyed it so much.
Well, you might go back to them.
Well, they did. You know, honestly, if they'd have said, "Look, we'd like to keep you writing this column, but we can only pay you half of what we've been paying you," I think I would have taken that deal. But that wasn't what they offered.
Well, we're glad you're still doing your thing at LSU and beyond. And we'll spend a few more minutes with Bob Mann, and then we're going to hear from Mark Peruskia. He has a fascinating story about how the FBI used a famous photographer to infiltrate the civil rights movement. 877-217-5757 is your number. Locally, 297-5633, and you can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. And we will spend a few more minutes with the versatile and ubiquitous Bob Mann after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. On deck is Mark Peruskia, and it is a fascinating book, A Spy in Canaan. We're finishing up with Bob Mann. And Sashika, who is on line 3? Can you tell me who we have is next? Okay. She's telling me we've got to wrap it up with Bob Mann. But it's always a pleasure to talk with you. And we're now a year, 6 months and 9 days away from the next governor's election. So it's amazing that there's only one announced candidate right now, the incumbent. What's going to happen?
I don't know. I think that, you know, the Governor Edwards job approval is much more resilient than I would have ever predicted, despite all the problems in the state, particularly with the budget that have not yet been resolved. I thought that people would be blaming him for that now, but I think that people perhaps are much more aware that the Republicans are giving him no help and that Bobby Jindal left him a big problem and that they're giving him more time than I anticipated. I think he deserves it because I think he was left a big, huge problem, and he's getting no help from more than half the legislature in really solving this. It's a shame.
And it looks like that there's still a strong possibility that his opponent will be John Kennedy.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's really crazy. The only thing I think is sometimes Kennedy has become the toast of Washington. He's a quote machine, and I think he really seems to enjoy being that. And perhaps he might decide that he wants to stay and continue seeing his quips appear in the pages of the Wall Street.
He's very good.
Yeah, he is very good.
He's very good, the luxury for him, though, is even if he were to lose, he's still a U.S. Senator for another 3 years at the least.
Free shot. Yep.
Well, thank you, Bob Mann.
Thank you, Jim.
Appreciate you. Mark Peruskia is a journalist for the Commercial Appeal, the daily newspaper in Memphis, one of the fine newspapers in America. Mark has worked the past 29 years there and has won numerous awards for his work, and he has a groundbreaking book, A Spy in Canaan, How the FBI Used a Famous Photographer to Infiltrate the Civil Rights Movement. And, Mark, I want to make sure I have you the correct pronunciation of your last name. If I messed it up, please let me know.
I think you got it right. It's Peruskia.
Okay, well, Peruskia. Now, you weave together three stories, and these stories are fascinating as far as how this occurred. And it's hard to believe it happened, but it did. Tell us about it.
Well, the book is about, in part, my discovery. You're right, it's three different parts. My discovery of this secret life of Ernest Withers, as part his biography as well. Ernest Withers was a famous photographer, especially out of Memphis. He's not a household name, obviously, but many of his pictures resonate across the country because he took all of these really powerful images of Dr. King riding the first integrated bus in Montgomery and Emmett Till's great uncle Moses Wright pointing an accusing finger in court at the teen's killers from the witness stand, and just on and on and on throughout the whole arc of the movement. And the other part of the book is what he was secretly doing for the FBI over much of this time. He was working as a paid informant for the FBI. He was kicking back a lot of information as J. Edgar Hoover's FBI took this very jaundiced view of the movement, and they were policing it to trying to root out communists and subversives and extremists and a whole wide swath of people that they viewed to be dangerous to the country.
Now, Ernest Withers, as you note, was a famous photographer and an African American. How did this union with the FBI occur?
Well, it took some time. Ernest first shows up in FBI reports in 1958. Now, the early years are sketchy. There isn't a lot of detail there, but starting in 1961, as the movement really started blossoming in the Memphis area, he starts working with an agent, William H. Lawrence. Lawrence ran the domestic intelligence unit for the Memphis field office for the better part of a quarter century, from the late 40s all the way until his retirement in 1970. And so they keep crossing paths as several things are happening in 1961. Freedom riders are coming back from their attempts to integrate public accommodations down in Mississippi. Some of them are coming home. They're viewed as, more militant, more radical than your traditional old school movement individual. You have the Nation of Islam is starting to appear here, and they open a mosque on Beale Street, and Ernest knows all these people. He can give the FBI all kinds of details as they build these dossiers, pictures, identification photos, home addresses, who they're related to, their blood relatives or associates, where they work, just on and on. He was quite helpful to them. And another thing going on in 61 was in the rural metro area here in Fayette County, Tennessee, you had a number of sharecroppers who were kicked off their land for trying to register to vote, and a number of relief agencies were coming in from the north. The Congress of Racial Equality and others were coming in. And again, the FBI viewed these outside agitators as, very dimly, as, communist-influenced subversives, people that they needed to watch. They kept a very suspicious eye on them, and Ernest helped them out in these investigations.
The book is A Spy in Canaan from our fine journalist, Mark Paraskia, from the Commercial Appeal in Memphis, Tennessee. Did Withers have any regrets about what he had done?
It's hard to know. He never spoke publicly about it. He did make one oblique comment to an interviewer once, in which he said that he knew Bill Lawrence, but it isn't clear in the passage. It's very short in this larger essay, even what he's trying to say. But, you know, Ernest was always in need of money. He had eight children to feed, and he was always hustling work. He was a very industrious individual. I mean, he had a photography studio down on Beale Street. He freelanced for, you know, newspapers and magazines, and at different times in his life, he was a police officer as well. And so he had this side thing with the FBI, too. So money was, you know, something that he needed, as we all do, and he had, you know, a lot of kids to take care of, and he was a good family man, a good provider. So, mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that he regretted this. There certainly isn't record any one way or the other, but I think, you know, because of his needs and, you know, he was a World War II veteran, 10 to 20 years older than a lot of people that he was reporting on. I think he was a bit more conservative than a lot of the people, certainly in the anti-war movement, which he informed on as well, that I don't think those kinds of things really were things that rattled him. I think he probably felt comfortable in what he was doing. And of course, you know, too, we have the benefit now of hindsight. We can look back at these and see, you know, how corrosive a lot of these investigations were to democracy, because, you know, they were investigating so many people who really were doing nothing. They weren't dangerous to the country. They were just standing up and exercising the lawful right to dissent and, you know, to march and to protest against the war and Jim Crow and that sort of thing. But, you know, back in the time, I mean, it was a different time. I mean, it was a time of high paranoia, mm-hmm. and, you know, probably the greatest internal crisis this country faced since the Civil War. So it was, you know, a very contentious era.
Now, the FBI tried to blackmail Martin Luther King. They had certainly some information about his personal life. Was Withers involved in getting that information to the Federal Bureau of Investigation?
Not with King. The thing about King is, even though Dr. King and his staff knew Ernest Withers, they liked him, and anytime they were in Memphis, they would, you know, they would get together and, you know, socialize and that sort of thing. But, you know, the Memphis field office, their file on Dr. King is quite thin, because, you know, he was based out of Atlanta. He came to Memphis sparingly. I mean, he came here in the late 50s. He came here in 1966 for the March Against Fear after James Meredith got shot, and he came here, you know, three different times in 1968 for the sanitation worker strike. So there really wasn't a whole lot of opportunity. Now, as Dr. King's staff came here in the weeks before the assassination and on for another year and a half, they came back repeatedly. He did do quite a bit of informing on his staff. You know, there was a lot of fear at that time that, you know, by the government, Hoover's FBI, that, you know, that King's organization might swing into more extremist type of activities. And a lot of that, again, was, you know, just the whole dim view that they took of it. But they were consciously looking for these kind of links. And he informed on a number of, you know, members of King's staff and, you know, within the SCLC here. He was on the board of directors of the Memphis chapter and was providing financial information and members on information mm-hmm. on various individuals.
The book, A Spy in Canaan, from Mark Paraskia. And as we part this hour, Mark, what's Memphis like today on the eve of the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death?
Well, of course, right now at this very moment, the whole mood of the city is very, very high. You know, it's the MLK 50 week, the 50th anniversary of the observation of Dr. King's assassination here. There are all manner of civil rights tourists and civil rights legends coming to town. You know, John Lewis, Diane Nash, Bernard Lafayette, just on and on and on, Jesse Jackson. And so right now we're kind of the mecca of ground zero of civil rights. So, I mean, it's an important story, you know, in this larger issue of civil rights. And I think it's an issue that you know, we need to be ever vigilant about government surveillance, because, you know, we need law and order, we need security in the country, but these, you know, the extreme investigations that they're doing back then, this is the thing that we need to guard against, you know, going forward in the future.
The book is A Spy in Canaan from Mark Paraskia. Important book. Thank you for joining us. We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. Stay
for
tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.